Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's an age-old lesson, a story so old it's biblical. Pride cometh before the fall. Long known as the leader in the auto industry, best-selling small car in the world, a darling of Consumer Reports and Car and Driver, a business model that was imitated around the globe, but when they became the world's largest automaker, things began to unravel. The changing fortunes of Toyota, oh, what a feeling, on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 22nd. The takeaway for me here, Todd, is does anyone want to be the world's largest automaker at this point? Looking at GM and Toyota, I wonder.
I think streamlined is more what it's about these days.
That's right.
All right, let's get right away to some of the top stories this morning. It's round two for the health care bill in the Senate this morning. We're waiting to hear how a second procedural vote went in the well. But as long as Democrats hold on to their 60 votes, it will be one step closer to final passage, now scheduled for Christmas Eve. Yesterday, President Obama hit back against critics who call this bill too expensive.
This cuts our deficit by $132 billion the first 10 years and by over a trillion in the second. That argument that opponents are making against this bill does not hold water.
Later on this morning, the president will meet with CEOs of several community banks at the White House. This comes as the recession's jobless toll is draining unemployment compensation funds so fast that, according to federal projections, 40 state programs will go broke within 2 years. Count Ford, among the companies hit hard by this recession, the Detroit automaker is offering buyouts or retirement incentive packages to all of its 41,000 hourly workers.
And Toyota is feeling that as well. For more on this, we're joined by Stephen Pekka. He's the pre-owned director of Scott Clark's Toyota City in Matthews, North Carolina. Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Celeste.
So, Stephen, what do you think is Toyota's reputation now? It's been a little bit battered. They had their first loss of profit in since their founding in the 1950s. So what is their reputation built on now?
Well, the reputation is still strong in the market. There's a lot of value as the customers still come in and enjoy the lineup of hybrids that we have to offer, where a lot of your other dealers are just getting in the market. We were the forerunner in the hybrid, which has been real strong across the nation.
Would you say that hybrids and low high gas economy vehicles are still their biggest selling point?
Very much so. And not only that, the low cost of ownership. You know, actually, you know, you brought it up in today's recession. Some of the recession as we end it, everyone's looking for great value, and that's where Toyota stands out.
Stephen Pekka is the pre-owned director of Scott Clark's Toyota City in Matthews, North Carolina. Stay with us, Steve. We'll be back with you in just a moment. Taking a look at Latin America now. In Colombia, FARC rebels are suspected of kidnapping the governor of a southwestern province. A rescue operation is reportedly underway. While in Mexico, the capital of Mexico City has legalized gay marriage, the first in Latin America to do so. The city also approved a resolution allowing married gay couples to adopt children.
Here at home, starting soon, if you get stuck on a grounded plane, it'll only be a three-hour purgatory and not an infinite ordeal. New rules say airlines won't be able to keep passengers stuck in planes for more than 3 hours. If they do, they'll be hit with nearly $30,000 fines per passenger. Let's take a look at the markets now. Snapping a string of losses, Asian markets closed higher yesterday. Today, European indices are up as well. Wall Street futures are up this morning. The Dow gets underway at 10,414. The S&P opens at 1,114. The NASDAQ opens at 2,237.
We're going to talk about work as we do every Tuesday. Coming up, what would you do to get a job? We'll talk about some people whitening their resumes. What does that mean? Later this hour. And we're remixing the holidays. Tell us what your favorite guilty pleasure holiday song is, and bonus points if you sing it to us. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the falling fortunes of Toyota.
So this is the Camry I heard about, huh? This is the big boy, the top of the line. This is as good as it gets.
Oh, really?
You know, you hear Lexus, Lexus, Lexus. You don't hear Camry, Camry. But that's what you should be hearing.
Well, tell me, what's in the engine here?
What's in it? Big stuff. Big charging, crazy pistons, nutty pistons.
That's Larry David trying to sell Toyotas on his show, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and he failed miserably at it.
Big surprise.
Exactly. But real Toyota dealers are also possibly facing a challenge in order to get Toyotas off their lots right now. There's been a string of bad news hitting the auto giants, multiple recalls, allegations of cover-ups, and an investigation over vehicle safety. We're going to look at from on the ground at a local Toyota dealership. We're joined again by Stephen Pekka. He's the pre-owned director of Scott Clark's Toyota City in Matthews, North Carolina. Good morning again, Stephen. Can you tell me what your sales numbers are so far this quarter?
Yeah, actually this quarter we're up, we've gained... we're a little bit different than norm. We've gained approximately 30% market share in our area.
Is that partially due to Cash for Clunkers?
That started the ball rolling, and we've had a great strong inventory all through the models. So we've been able to provide the customers that wanted the product with the product.
So you've got the largest recall ever from Toyota, more than 4 million vehicles or so. It's been blamed for 13 crashes, 5 fatalities, 17 injuries. This is not something we're used to hearing out of Toyota. And I'm wondering if you've had anyone come in and express concerns over safety or reliability.
Very, very, very little, Celeste. A lot of that was, excuse me for saying, but media more so than an actual fault in the floor mats of the Toyota. That's what it was based upon. And
you're saying that the media, that there's no foundation for the recall?
Very little, as you notice right now, even in your automotive news, which is our industry leader, it came, it hit, and it was gone within about a 30-day period of time.
Okay. Stephen Pekka is the pre-owned director of Scott Clark's Toyota City in Matthews, North Carolina. Thanks so much, Stephen.
You're welcome, Celeste.
To get another view from an analyst on this, on Toyota and the overall picture on the auto industry, we bring back a friend of the Takeaway, Paul Eisenstein. He's publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I'm feeling wounded and blamed.
Yeah, well, it's your fault that Toyota is catching flack over this recall. You heard Stephen say that this isn't a real problem.
I don't know what planet he's on. I have a little problem taking blame for the fact that Toyota has voluntarily agreed to recall something like four times as many vehicles as it ever did in a single year, and that the investigation by federal authorities is continuing because they're not yet completely satisfied with the explanation, and that it's going to take them months to get this thing resolved, and the fact that it's not the only recall. They also have the recall of Tundras, their full-size pickup, that have had such serious corrosion that they're in danger of having the spare tires fall off on the road and their brakes fail catastrophically, and the fact that they are in danger of having another recall of 300-some thousand 2006 Corollas and Matrixes, two mainstays. And there have been other recalls and other problems. And, I'm losing my breath.
Yeah, but other than that, what's the problem, Paul?
There's also a whistleblower who has been out there saying that Toyota's been hiding information about a safety problem. Toyota tried to tar and feather him for a while, and the courts have said, wait a second, this guy has some serious information.
Don't destroy
evidence.
This is the former Toyota lawyer who's filed a lawsuit saying that they didn't disclose the results from rollover crash tests. Is that right?
Correct, yeah.
And this is, as I was saying to Stephen, this is not what we are used to hearing about Toyota. They have built their reputation on high-quality, high-reliability cars.
Well, here's the good side. Stephen is right that people still are coming into Toyota dealers. I publish on not just my site, the DetroitBureau.com, but a lot of other places, and I do still hear people saying, wow, Toyota's standing behind us because they're doing this recall. They've built a reputation for quality and reliability, and it's helping carry them through with a lot of people. If this were a recall at Ford or GM in particular, we'd probably see people freaking out and leaving the dealerships in droves. So this is a good thing about spending so many years building a reputation. The problem is that now that reputation is getting tarnished, it's getting scratched. And the fact that they're also getting hit by people like J.D. Power and Associates and Strategic Visions and other analysts, even Consumer Reports magazine, for quality problems and other issues, that's starting to put them in a position where their vaunted and long-fought-for reputation for quality is starting to slip.
I think probably one of the worst things is make this a media issue is they had a crash that killed an off-duty California Highway Patrolman and a family of three.
Yeah, that one in August was spectacular. It was a sort of crash that you see in the movies where the vehicle races out of control, hits speeds over 100 miles an hour, leaps into the air off the side of the road, goes flying great distance, lands, rolls, and then bursts into flames, killing all four. But it's not the only one, and part of the problem is they now have not just the recall, but they have a class action lawsuit, at least one that I know of, and individual lawsuits on top of that, claiming that there are other problems, mysterious gremlins, which a lot of us, frankly, in the media are skeptical about and have been raising questions about whether these claims are valid. But the fact is, they're out there, and people are raising these claims, and that's another problem that Toyota has to face.
Well, I think the concern among many people is perhaps Toyota became too large. They took over the world's largest automaker spot from GM. But my question to you is, how are they doing in comparison to the big three auto companies? Is Detroit doing any better?
Well, Detroit is not having these sort of recalls right now, which is good. In fact, Consumer Reports magazine, which an awful lot of people, a lot of import buyers pay close attention to, Consumer Reports came in to Detroit and announced their annual findings on vehicle reliability and praised Ford Motor Company in particular, had mixed results for the other two Detroit makers. And we're starting to see on the quality front, Detroit is starting to pick up, and that's really helping them. Toyota, yeah, they're doing better, and they are getting some good bounce from a few places like Consumer Reports. But Detroit is clearly catching up on the quality front in almost all the surveys out there, with the exception of Chrysler, which is in just deep trouble and can't seem to get its act together. Ford in particular and GM are closing on it, and that could help them in the next couple of years. It's interesting to note that Ford, your guest a moment ago, the dealer, mentioned the hybrids. And there's really only one hybrid in the U.S. selling, and that is the Toyota Prius. Everything else is sort of an also-ran on the sales charts. But Ford is coming up quick on Toyota with the hybrid, the Fusion hybrid, which is getting 4 miles a gallon better mileage than the Toyota Camry hybrid.
Well, we do have end-of-year auto sales coming out soon, and we'll have to check in with you on that, Paul, and see if we can interpret what they mean when we get them. Paul Eisenstein is the publisher of the Detroit Bureau Online. Thanks so much, Paul. It is 15 minutes past the hour. Let's check in now on the headlines.
In Washington, senators are at work right now on health care. We should have the results any moment of the second test vote on the health care bill. It's expected this morning. Final vote in this on the Senate bill is expected by Christmas Eve. President Obama sits down with the representatives of smaller and community banks this morning. He's expected to emphasize the importance of lending to small businesses. David Gillen is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Speaking with us earlier this morning, he said many smaller banks are having trouble in the fallout of the financial crisis.
I think what you have here with the community banks is overall they are trying to lend, but many of them, in fact, do have some problems and some significant problems.
In the last 50 years, economic downturns have increased crime, and increases in crime have arrived in tandem with those downturns, but that's not so this time. Preliminary FBI figures show crime falling nationwide during the first 6 months of this year.
Abroad, the high-speed rail link between Britain and France is up and running again. It was shut down for 3 days. Holiday travelers were stranded after trains broke down in the Channel Tunnel on Friday, trapped about 2,000 passengers for several hours. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, who'd ever turn down $500 million, especially if the money came from Google? Well, we're going to talk about who turned it down in just a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
It's time for The Takeout, so look at quick stories we want you to keep on top of this week. First up, we've got a business story that's leaving some folks in the tech sector scratching their heads this morning. An online rating website, Yelp, walked away from an acquisition deal worth over $500 million, and that's from Google of all places. Who turns down a Google? Who turns down a Google deal of $500 million? That's the question. To answer that, we have John Abel, New York bureau chief for Wired.com. John, welcome. Good morning.
Good morning,
John. First off, for any of our listeners who don't know, please explain, what is Yelp?
Yelp is a social network in which people review restaurants and bars and nightlife and shopping and things like that. It's a user-generated site where people discuss the places that they've been and whether they like it or not. It's sort of an open source Zagat.
And millions of users. I would assume that anyone who has a $500 million offer has a lot of members.
They have a lot of members. They have a wonderful iPhone app. They've got a lot of buzz, yeah.
So why would a site with a lot of buzz and a lot of members walk away from a $500 million deal?
Clearly they think they're worth more. And whether they think they're worth more in a deal with Google or in a deal with the next round of venture capitalists or in an IPO, we don't know. We don't even know how close this deal was or whether there was a deal. But when you turn down a $500 million, it means you think you're worth more.
And is there any way for people outside of the room, like you and me, to know if they are worth more?
Sure, I suppose so. I mean, a lot of this stuff is potentiality, and we saw a lot of these things go south and go really north before the dot-com bust. It could be worth a lot more, and it could be worth nothing. We'll know soon.
And where is the inherent value in a Yelp, bringing millions of people to the table who are interested in retail, interested in going to restaurants, movies, and interested in buying things, I would assume?
Yeah, you know exactly the demographic of your users, and that makes it easier to target ads towards them and to use their content to leverage other things like mapping and that sort of thing.
All right, Google has a lot of heft in the marketplace, but they can't bring Yelp on board for $500 million. John Abel, New York Bureau Chief for Wired.com, thanks for joining us.
Our next takeout comes from the Mojave Desert in California. Daniel Stone is a senior writer for Newsweek magazine. Welcome. First off, there is a new proposed environmental protection bill coming from Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. Can you tell me what is in this bill?
Sure. This is really an effort from Senate Democrats, like you said, led by Senator Feinstein, to protect about 1 million acres of the Mojave Desert in the eastern half of Southern California. It would rope off the land to any development, including and most notably to solar and wind energy producers who see great value in that land.
We always see proposals on the table coming out of different organizations to protect bits of the country. What's different about this one?
What's different is that this one actually has a shot at passing. You see a lot of support behind this effort, of course, by environmentalists who want to rope off that land, but of course also from the off-roading industry and also by conservationists who donated that land to California about a decade ago. And they say, you know, the original intent of that donation was that it stays protected and doesn't get developed with roads and wind turbines and solar panels.
Okay, so she's introducing that today. Any idea how many votes she has so far?
I think most of her colleagues are focused on a different issue today and certainly this week.
I wonder
week
what
I'm
that healthcare. Is. Okay, great. Thanks so much. Daniel Stone is a senior writer for Newsweek.
All right, our last takeout, Monday Night Football with Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. He's here. Ibrahim, before we get started on the Redskins versus the Giants, you need to listen to something that you said on this show yesterday in reference to the Washington Redskins.
They have a great defense. They have a lot of key pieces to a puzzle. So I wouldn't say that they're that bad, and I would say to Redskins fans that you have the basic nucleus of a really good team.
A great defense?
Well, that's interesting. They have a lot of Pro Bowl players on their defense that are
a great defense
that are injured.
So
last night, as you were saying so eloquently, the Giants crushed the Redskins 45-12. And you're right; their defense didn't play so good. And I think it was more so that the Giants recognized what the stakes are for them, and they came out very, very focused.
Now, that's the other thing you said yesterday. You said they had a great defense. You were wrong. But the thing that you were right about was that the Giants wanted and needed a big win, and clearly they got it.
And the reason for this is that there's two games left in the season for the Giants, the Green Bay Packers, and the Dallas Cowboys. The Giants are vying for
the NFC now.
NFC. They're vying for that last spot in the NFC playoffs with those two teams. they have the Giants have the benefit of having a tiebreaker against those two teams, meaning that they've beaten both of them in their meetings this season. So should they win all the rest of the games, they should get into the playoffs.
The Giants defense absolutely hammering the Redskins QB last night to the ground. The poor guy just got rattled.
It was tough. The Giants have been struggling with their pass rush for most of the season. 3 years ago, they amassed between their three top pass rushers, they had 27 sacks. This year, they only have 15. Yesterday, they had 5. So it was a great day for the Giants defense.
All right, let's get on to the NHL real quickly. You've been following New Jersey Devils goalie Martin Brodeur. What's the latest with him?
Well, he finally did what he's been trying to do all season,
but he
doesn't want to talk about it because he wants to get over it. But he finally broke a 40-year-old record. He is now the NHL's all-time leader in shutouts with 104 shutouts.
104. I mean, this guy could become the athlete of our time.
He's definitely one of the most overlooked and great athletes of our decade.
All right, Ibrahim, I want to get to something because we're kicking off an end-of-the-year series with you. This is great. You've compiled your list of the top 10 most memorable sports stories of 2009. Give us your first installment here.
Number one is Usain Bolt breaking the world record in the 100-meter dash.
4, 5, and 6. They're away. Terrific start by Daniel Bailey. Usain Bolt, though, getting into his running. Here he comes. Usain Bolt, 2 clear meters. Tyson Gay in second place.
9.58, smashing the world record. Unbelievable. He's done it again.
So 2 years ago, he smashed the world record, and this year he beat it again with a 9.58. It's an unbelievable record. Usain Bolt is the fastest man in the world.
All right, we're going to get to the rest of your top 10 most memorable sports stories throughout this week and next. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
All this week, we're mixing holiday music to give it a new spin, but you might harbor a secret joy of a carol or tune over your own. So tell us, what's your guilty pleasure of a holiday song? Bonus points if you sing it for us, 8778-MY-TAKE, mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, we talk about the latest from Iran, where thousands of protesters took to the streets in mourning. More on that in just a few minutes. Right now, let's check in on top stories at 31 minutes past the hour. This just in, a key procedural vote on health care reform has succeeded in the Senate. That means that Democrats still have those 60 votes they need to move on to the next phase. A final vote on the health care bill is expected on Christmas Eve. In Afghanistan this morning, NATO Secretary General Anders Rasmussen said the alliance is unwavering in its military support.
The international community will stand with you, will protect you, and help rebuild your country.
It's Rasmussen's first visit to Afghanistan since the announcement of the U.S. surge. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani says he will not be running for governor of New York next year. At a press conference later today, he's expected to endorse ex-GOP Congressman Rick Lazio for the race.
More than half of all criminal cases brought by the federal government this year had to do with immigration violations. That's according to a new report from Syracuse University. The report found that federal prosecutions were up 9% from last year. Most of that jump was due to immigration cases. And state unemployment compensation funds are fast running out. Federal projections show 40 state programs could go broke in 2 years. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow will get underway at 10,414, the S&P at 1,114, and the NASDAQ will open at 2,237. That's some of the news stories we're following this morning.
The death and funeral of Iran's most senior dissident cleric spurred large protests by the opposition movement there this weekend. Since disputed elections this summer, Iran's government has cracked down on protesters and kept a tight lid on the media, and the country continues to ignore American demands to halt all nuclear programs. Borzu Dargahi is the Middle East correspondent, Middle East bureau chief for the LA Times, and he's managed to continue reporting from Iran. He joins us now from Beirut. He's just left Iran. Borzu, you were there in Tehran when Ayatollah Hussein Montazeri, the top dissident cleric, died on Saturday. We know these protests were tough to cover with all the restrictions on the media and the protesters themselves. What were they like?
Even local media were severely restricted in what they could report about the protests. And of course, the protesters themselves, armed with little cell phone cameras, managed to totally circumvent any of the restrictions and get the word about the protests. There was tens of thousands of people who descended upon Iran's very important shrine city of Qom. This is the theological center of of the country, as well as an important, some say the most important place of learning right now in the entire Shiite faith. And so you had this extraordinary mixture of people who included seminary students and clerics, along with this cleric, Hussein Ali Montazeri's supporters from very rural parts of the country. And then added to that mix, you had very chic, middle-class, educated people from the capital who all came together to mourn this gentleman, and they all turned this into a massive protest against the government. Slogans included death to the dictator, which is taking on, at this point, a much more potentially radical edge. Slogans included Mir Hussein, support of Mir Hussein Mousavi, the opposition figurehead who ran against President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and lost in a disputed election. And so this was a rather electric moment in this whole six-month drama, and it will continue in the coming days.
Well, let me ask you about that electrifying moment, Borzu Deragahi, Middle East correspondent for the LA Times. Is this, you mentioned all the different groups who were converging around the mourning period in the death of this cleric. Is this a cohesive movement against the government, or is sort of a more amorphous sentiment against what people see as an Iranian dictatorship drawing people together? Do they have one purpose, or is it just sort of anti-government sentiment from all around the country, kind of loosely affiliated?
I think that it is coalescing against a general demand that Ahmadinejad be taken out and that the country shift direction. And I think that's like the kind of minimum that people want. They want to go back to the direction of the reformist movement of the late 90s and earlier this decade. They do not like the direction the country is going.
And Borzu, let me ask you though, what is the tip of this movement? Is it still Mousavi, who lost the disputed election to against Ahmadinejad? Is he still the tip of this? Do they want Mousavi in? Do they know what they want?
I think that they are. Everyone continues to chant that slogan, Ya Hussein, Mir Hussein. That is it remains a very, very important slogan. It's often the first slogan that's chanted at demonstrations, small and large. So I think, yes, I think that is still true. Some people disagree. They say that the movement has become more radical. Even those more radical people, there's a level of maturity among them, where they recognize that, you know, you can't just they know the lessons of the 1979 revolution, and they don't want to repeat what they perceive as some of the mistakes from back then, and they would prefer, even those people would prefer, a slower transition that is not cataclysmic, that doesn't cost lives, that doesn't lead to the guillotine, and so even those more radical ones who want an abolition of the Islamic Republic recognize the value in having a transition.
Borzu, Middle East correspondent for the LA Times, we heard from Robert Wirth yesterday of the New York Times, and he said that at this point, protesters are taking any opportunity at all to mount protests against the government, and suggested that perhaps we're going to continue to see them and perhaps a ramp up in them. And I'm wondering, what about the government response? Do we know if the government response is also ramping up?
The government has tried every single tool in its arsenal so far. They've, you know, shot at demonstrators. They've used tear gas. They've put lots of controls over the media. They've tried to discredit the opposition with these what critics describe as show trials. And so they've tried all these things that have worked in the past, and they haven't worked. So, I mean, it leaves them with, a few options left and a lot of margin of error, a lot of potential for error, very little margin of error, actually. They could open fire on demonstrators in a Tiananmen Square style attempt to crack down on the protests, but there's so many risks with that move.
Borzu, what about just before we go? I want to ask you about the life in the rest of Iran. The protests are obviously growing. That was in the city of Qom, not in Tehran this time. Daily life in Iran consumed by political protests. Give us a quick feel of the country right now, if you could.
Well, it's quite extraordinary, actually. Normal life continues. People are shopping. People are going to work. There's a sort of lively sentiment in the air as the winter begins, and the weather goes from cold to warm in a few hours. But many people beneath the surface are pursuing the aims of this protest movement, and it's sort of become like a part-time job to them to be political activists.
Now, Borzu, you wrote about a blind conductor conducting a women's orchestra in Iran, part of daily life continuing in that country. I want to thank you for joining us. Borzu Daragahi, Middle East correspondent for the LA Times, joined us from Beirut. We want to play some of that orchestra that you've been writing about. Thanks, Borzu. Coming up, we talk about your work life every Tuesday and what would you do to land a job?
My birth name is Darwish Zabir Ishmael Ghani, and I changed it to Tom Haverford because, brown guys with funny-sounding Muslim names don't make it really far in politics.
Would you go as far as to whiten your resume? We'll talk about exactly what that means later this hour.
Keep the conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick. I want you to listen to this. This is the sound of a 13-year-old boy. His name is Joseph Banda. He's living in a slum in Zambia, and here he's talking about his dreams of becoming a pilot.
I want to be a pilot when I grow up so that I can go to many countries and meet many people. Maybe, who knows, maybe I may be taking the president to countries. It happens.
Now tell us about this boy's story of Joe Fidgen. She's a freelance reporter for our partner, the BBC. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, good morning.
Tell us about this boy's story. Maybe you'll tell us why we're hearing about this one little boy, a poor kid growing up in a slum in Zambia.
He's an incredible boy, actually, and the story that he had to tell initially was about the place where he grew up. It's a place called Chibolia. It's a slum area in Lusaka. It's a very tough place. It's the center of the drug trade here. There's lots of crime, alcoholism, cholera, diseases. It's a pretty unpleasant place, and I met him when I was there, and he has an extraordinarily optimistic, cheerful temperament, given the conditions that he's living in. So he gave me a tour of his hometown, which was broadcast around the place, and a lot of people were very moved by what he said. And we just heard him talking about being a pilot, about wanting to be a pilot. A number of listeners came forward and said, we want to help him achieve that dream. And so, in fact, one of them, a pilot from California called Keith Johns, actually paid for Joseph to have a flying lesson, which was a very special moment, actually.
The listeners were so inspired by Joseph Banda, actually. They paid for a bike that would get him back and forth to school. Another wants to bring him to the United States to study. And as you say, he got his first flying lesson. You were with him when he flew.
I was. It was a very fun day. But Joseph, when he was in the first year of school, was taken to the airport, shown the inside of a plane, decided at that point, I want to be a pilot. But he hadn't been back since. And that was, 5 or 6 years ago. We went up in the plane. He had a theory lesson showing how the plane worked. Then we went up. We had a 45-minute flight. Joseph flew the whole thing, did the takeoff, did the whole flight. The only thing the professional pilot did was help him land. And it was an incredible performance, I have to say. I'm not good in small planes, and I did feel a little bit sick in the back, but that was more the plane than Joseph. We had a great time, and you would never believe that this was such an extraordinary experience for him. He's a very cool customer.
Well, actually hear from that cool customer. We have a surprise guest today, and that's Joseph Banda himself. Maybe you would hand the headphones over to him. Joseph, are you there?
Hello.
Hi there. How
yes.
are you?
Very fine, thank you. And how are you?
Good. Could you tell me a little bit about what your first flying lesson was like?
Well, at first I couldn't believe it because I never even thought I would fly a plane at my age. I thought like when I was old enough to fly a plane, that's when I would fly a plane. But one day I was sitting home and then mom came and said they phoned that you're going to fly a plane tomorrow. So I prepared my clothes in the morning. They came to pick me up. We went there. He showed me some things. Like the propeller and the hangar where the planes are kept, and we went to the plane. He showed me how the things worked, and he told me how the things were put in there. And then we started off.
That's 13-year-old Joseph Bonda talking about what it was like to fly a plane. He lives in a slum in Zambia, Africa. We were also joined by Joe Fidgen, freelance reporter for our partner, the BBC.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use...
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick, who's filling in for John Hockenberry. And coming up, what would you do to get a job? If you've been looking for a job for a long time, would you whiten up your resume? I'm not talking about getting brighter paper. We'll tell you what it means in just a moment. All this week, though, we're remixing holiday music. We want to give holiday music a new flavor. If you have a secret joy for a certain carol or holiday song, let us know. What is your guilty pleasure in holiday music? Bonus points if you sing it.
My name is Guguletu Zigalala. I live in New York, but I grew up in South Africa. I just went to visit my family. And favorite Christmas song that I grew up listening to that I still love is Bonnie M. And it goes like... Mary's born child, Jesus Christ, was born on Christmas Day.
Okay, let's know it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. First, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes past the hour. Some economic figures just out. The economy grew 2.2% in the third quarter of this year. The Associated Press says the rebound in the economy is a little weaker than many analysts expected. And the latest test vote on the Senate health care bill succeeded this morning. A final vote on the bill is expected on Christmas Eve. It'll then need to be reconciled with the House bill before going to the president for signing.
The high-speed rail service linking Britain, France, and Belgium is up and running again after being shut down for 3 days. Holiday travelers were stranded after trains broke down in the Channel Tunnel on Friday, trapping around 2,000 passengers. Ian Nunn is from Eurostar, the company that runs the trains.
We're doing our level best to get everybody where they should be by Christmas.
Well, those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
Tuesday already. Well, it's time to talk about work on the takeaway. And because we have an unemployment rate above 10%, oftentimes that means we're talking about the lack of work. And many people are doing some things they may not have expected to in order to find a job. One of those things is whitening their resumes, especially for employers for whom race is still an issue. We talked to Chaz Kaiser, the author of the book Embracing the Real World, The Black Woman's Guide to Life After College. John Hockenberry talked to her about what whitening your resume is and what it means to do that, and whether Chaz thinks this subtle discrimination is indeed still a big issue.
Oh, it definitely is. And more reports, more studies are coming out showing that racial discrimination is still a factor, but there's different ways that people are discriminating against people based on their race, including their names and the type of hairstyles that they have. Ethnic names, ethnic hairstyles.
Well, ethnic sounding name. I'm John Hockenberry. I guess that is ethnic in the sense that it's
that
obviously
ethnic,
white.
Obviously white. And so
white.
What's happened? you would be called to have a white-sounding name. There are studies that have shown that people with quote-unquote white-sounding names, i.e. John, Brad, and Carrie, are 50% more likely to get called back in for an interview than people with a quote-unquote black-sounding name,
there's,
i.e. Keisha,
there's
Jamal.
The number. Or Tuare Murray, who joins us from Stillwater, Oklahoma. Good morning, Tuare.
Good morning.
So you actually had to make a decision based on the ethnic sound of your name to get a job. Explain how you made the calculation.
Well, my name was Tuare Ajanaku, and for me, it really became a matter of survival. I'm a certified medical technologist. I have a BS in chemistry, and I was working actually at a very, very small privately owned laboratory doing health screenings, very underemployed. Prior to that, well, I spent almost a year applying for numerous positions with hospitals and major lab companies. Impressive resume, but I got very little feedback or interest in my resume.
And the difference between Akanju and Murray was really the difference.
I just made the decision to give myself every possible chance. And I legally changed my last name to Murray.
And you are employed now, right?
I am.
Well, first of all, congratulations to you. But if the reason that Tuare Murray is employed is because she had to change her name, Chas Kaiser. How do you distinguish between the statistical basis for having to make these kinds of changes to so-called whiten your resume and just mm-hmm. the fear, just purely the fear?
Well, you can't, and that's what makes it so hard. But that's the same thing, you know, for sex or race. You go into an interview and you really don't know if you're going to be discriminated against because you're a woman or because you're black or because you're a foreigner. You just fear that you may be.
You know, this is an interesting issue because, Chas, I'm in a wheelchair, right? And I've never actually had an issue of discrimination in my employment. And when I was working for NBC, we did this story on discrimination on the basis of disability. And I said to them, but you never really know. How are you going to figure this out?
Know.
And but the producer said to me, no, here's how we're going to know. We're going to send somebody in, first of all, in a wheelchair, and then we're going to send somebody in not in a wheelchair, and you'll be able to see the discrimination when the person not in the chair gets the job. And I said, oh, right. And it was unbelievable, the amount of discrimination you saw.
And as the study showed, I mean, you have people with white-sounding names 50% more likely to get called back in for an interview. And this is even when people with the black-sounding names had better credentials. So, I mean, there's hard evidence there. As far as the, for example, the hair, there haven't been any exact studies done on hair, but black people will tell you when they take away their locks, when they take away their braids, people treat them differently. People look at them differently. It's like people look at them like they're more professional because their hair is straighter.
You know,
and so it's really a matter of perception.
Chas, this is a question for you or Tuere. Many people look at the statistics about the underemployment of African Americans, especially, and African American men in particular. And oftentimes they think, well, African Americans tend to live in urban areas. Maybe they tend to have disadvantages in terms of education. And they think these are the problems. And I have to wonder, are there these same kind of trends for other minority groups? Do Hispanics see that they have to change their name? We get lots and lots of doctors from, say, India. Do they have to change their name?
Well, actually, yes. Well, there's been studies to show that people with foreign names are also less likely to get hired.
Tuere Murray, any advice for people who are looking at their resume, dusting it off in this moment of 10% unemployment?
I honestly believe that the interest that I got in my resume after I changed my name, and it was significantly more, I think it had to do with my name first. Just trying to get in the door, and then, you know, the rest is on you, of course, at the interview to, you know, kind of make or break the deal. But, you know, for me, it became a matter of, I think, just getting in the door, just having my resume not stuck to the bottom and at least being considered seriously.
Tuere, I have to ask you, because I know my African-American friends, and I know what their response would be to this. What did they say to you when you changed your name? Did they think that you were selling out?
Honestly, I didn't tell a lot of people at first because I've personally felt that way myself, but I also know I have two children. I'm a single mom. I know it's tough out here. I'm unemployed. That's scary enough. And I just really felt like I had to do what I had to do. You know, I got a few sneers and jeers, you know, and a couple of comments, but it was quite intense sometimes, yes. Mm. Yes.
Well, intense sneers and jeers and losing a paycheck, that can be pretty intense as well.
Yes.
I definitely feel your pain there. Tuere Murray, who had to make the decision to change her name as a way of dealing with the very competitive job market in the middle of this recession, joining us from Stillwater, Oklahoma. Thanks so much, Tuere.
Oh, you're welcome.
And Chas Kaiser is author of the book Embracing the Real World, The Black Woman's Guide to Life After College. Thanks so much, Chas.
Thank you.
John and I spoke with both of them last week.
So the holidays are upon us now, and all this week we're remixing holiday music to give it a new spin. But you might harbor a secret joy for a carol or two yourself. So tell us, what's your guilty pleasure holiday song? Of course, bonus points if you sing it for us.
This is Mary Ann from Detroit. My favorite holiday song is Malagkalikimaka.
Is the thing to say.
Because it reminds me of a Griswold Christmas.
And here's a special singer.
Good morning, Troy calling from North Dakota. You know, public radio always making those on-air appeals for funding. I will write a check for $100 and drop it in the mail tomorrow if Femi Okay comes on the air and sings the whole song, my favorite Christmas song, Santa Baby.
Good morning, Troy. Happy holidays. Now, I'm not in the studio this morning, but it doesn't mean we can't be Christmassy. Santa Baby, slip a sable under the tree for me.
Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, and hurry down the chimney tonight. Happy holidays, everybody.
Oh, Troy, that's $100, man. There you go. You can use it to get your baby boy a really great present.
It's 778-MY-TAKE, or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. We are going to be taking your requests and your songs all week long. Be sure to call in or send us an email. And don't forget to tune in on Friday. We have a special Christmas Day edition of The Takeaway from Christmas of 1941. All the news, sound of real voices from people just weeks after Pearl Harbor, just as we were getting into World War II. Sports, movies, and music from 1941. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. When you go down to the bank for a loan, you're probably not clanging on the 5-ton doors of Goldman Sachs. No, you'll go to see a community bank, the little guy, someone you know. The community banks didn't cause this financial failure, but they're not lending much either. Not for new office equipment, not for a new truck, definitely not for a new house. But people aren't asking for much.
Say, don't you remember? I was your pal.
Down at the White House today, a softer touch for the community banks. At least, we've got some advice to lend on The Takeaway.
Money, can you spare a dime?
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, December 22nd. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in this morning for John Hockenberry, who is away for the holidays. And of course, I'm here with Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, Todd. Let's get right to the news. Two down, two to go. In the past hour, the health care bill cleared another 60-vote test in the Senate, this one to shut off debate over the bill. Democrats remained united as they pushed toward their goal of passing a Senate health care bill by Christmas. But Senator Lindsey Graham told the Today Show last hour, Republicans are vowing to continue their fight.
The reason no Republican is going to vote for this bill is because when it's over, 80% of the country will be in government-run health care, and the 20% who have private health care today are eventually going to have their premiums go up.
Yesterday, President Obama said that type of criticism is just not justified.
This cuts our deficit by $132 billion the first 10 years and by over $1 trillion in the second. That argument that opponents are making against this bill does not hold water.
Also coming out in the past half hour, new economic numbers showing the economy grew 2.2% in the third quarter. That's a little weaker than what many economists expected. To help jumpstart the economic recovery, President Obama will gather the CEOs of some community banks at the White House, where he's expected to ask them to lend more, particularly to small businesses.
Now, Mike Menzies is president and CEO of Easton Bank and Trust in Eastern Maryland, and he joins us now. Mr. Menzies, what can the president say today to your colleagues to get your industry to start lending?
You know, Todd and Celeste, real community banks never stopped lending. That's our bread and butter. We're not Wall Street traders. We're community lenders, and that's how we make a living.
Except that your money filters through Wall Street, and credit is certainly tight at the community banks. Anyone trying to get a home loan or a small business loan can tell you that.
Well, you haven't visited Easton Bank and Trust then, Todd and Celeste, because we've been out there looking for loans and working to make loans. Community banks are about community, and the health of our community defines the health of our bank.
Okay, Mike Menzies says business is good and lending is flowing at Easton Bank and Trust in Easton, Maryland. Mike, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. The Ford Motor Company is offering buyouts or retirement incentive packages to all of its 41,000 hourly workers. The buyouts include $50,000 in cash and health care for 6 months. Ford says it has more workers than it needs as it looks to return to profitability in 2011. On to the markets now. Ending a string of losses, Asian markets closed higher. European indices are up as well. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow gets underway at 10,414. The S&P opens at 1,114, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,237.
All this week, we're remixing holiday music, and we asked Broadway star Brian Stokes Mitchell about holiday music. He's going to talk to us later this hour, but maybe you like your music unmixed. Do you have a secret holiday pleasure?
This is Kim from Brooklyn. One of my favorite holiday songs. They've got cows, digging stars, they've got rivers of gold. But the wind blows so brilliant, no place for the old. When you first took my hand on a cold Christmas Eve, you promised me Broadway was waiting for me.
That is Fairy Tale to New York from the Pogues. 8778-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Let us know what your guilty pleasure holiday song is. Well, our listeners can sing.
They've
got some
sure
pretty good singers out there. Coming up, we're going to talk about more about small banks. No singing, though, and how to get them lending again. That's coming up in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. President Obama is slated to meet with lenders from small and community banks today at the White House 1 week after meeting with the heads of the major banks. He's likely to make the same request to them as he did to the big banks, which is, please, please lend more. Might be sort of a different tone for the smaller banks than for the big ones, though. Greg Hernandez, spokesman for the FDIC, put 2009 in perspective for the banking industry on Saturday.
So far in 2009, there have been 140 bank failures, the most since 1992 when there were 181, which was the tail end of the savings and loan crisis.
So will small and community banks be able to make more loans as the president is requesting? And secondary to that, maybe primary, how many of them will survive? Joining us is David Gillen, finance editor for the New York Times, and rejoining us, Mike Menzies, president and CEO of a small community bank. That's Eastern Bank and Trust in Eastern Maryland. Mike, you said in the open there that business is good. At least you suggested that business is very good at Eastern Bank and Trust and that you're lending. How many loans, let's say under $10,000, have you made in this quarter versus the same quarter last year? What's the state of your bank right now?
Todd, what I think I said is that real community banks never really stopped lending, and we have not stopped lending. And that is not to say that all community banks aren't going through the correction, the real estate correction, and the economic correction that's going on throughout the nation. But we never stopped lending. We never slowed our lending down in terms of motivating lenders to go find borrowers, to find qualified borrowers. The slowdown is not because community banks haven't always made common sense loans. The slowdown is because we've gone through an economic slowdown.
Just an economic slowdown. But don't small and community banks have trouble borrowing money from other banks, from bigger banks, from Wall Street banks, or is that not a factor?
You know, that's a great question there, Todd, because community banks don't go to the Federal Reserve and borrow a couple hundred billion dollars to carry assets that are already on their books. Community banks are traditional lenders. They gather deposits when loan demand is there, and they make loans. And we've done that all along. And if we need deposits, we can gather deposits with the best of them. So we're not traders. We're not brokers. We're not the classic Wall Street go buy your money and lend your money out type organizations. We're traditional intermediaries, and that's a big difference between community banks and Wall Street.
David Gillen from the New York Times, you heard Mike Menzies. This begs the question as to whether or not the correction that Mike is talking about is perhaps going to a more simplified financial industry as we had in past years, where we don't allow banks to become multi-financial conglomerates that do all of those things.
Well, this is the argument about making banks boring again, making banking boring, getting out of a lot of the financial engineering and so forth that has done so much damage to both the economy and to the financial system. I personally don't think that it's really possible to put that genie back in the bottle, and a lot of the more complicated products that are out there, in fact, people would find credit to homeowners and small businesses would be even tighter perhaps than it is.
And with all of the banking regulations that are being discussed in Washington, repealing Glass-Steagall, meaning separating financial instruments from traditional banking and credit cards, is not under discussion.
It's not under serious discussion.
Not under serious, not from anyone who's actually making any of these decisions. David Gillen from the New York Times, I had another question I wanted to ask you. The president, when he met with the big bankers a couple of weeks ago, reportedly reiterated his point from earlier in the year, which was, this story might be apocryphal now, but was something to the effect, the White House is the only thing standing between you guys and the pitchforks, populist anger. A different message today for the smaller banks, you think?
Oh, I think very much so. First of all, you have to recognize that the message from the administration has been increasingly conciliatory since the spring. I think that the meeting with the large banks recently was far friendlier than the previous meetings, or indeed some of the harsher words that came out from the White House in the early part of the year, particularly as it regards to pay and so forth. I think what you have here with the community banks is overall they are trying to lend, but many of them, in fact, do have some problems and some significant problems. And so it's striking a balance, as Mike said, between making prudent loans and just lending to anybody who's got a temperature.
So Mike, if you were in the room today with the president, and I know several of your colleagues will be, and he says, please lend, you say, Mr. President, we have been lending, we're trying, but the economy is bad. What other answer do you have for him?
Well, we tell the president that we're going to continue to do what we've done all along, which is make common sense loans based upon cash flow and the ability of the borrower to repay their debt, and that hasn't changed. But I would like to make a note about what David said. You know, there are 8,100 banks in this nation, 8,100 banks, and the lion's share of those community banks are well-capitalized, well-managed, and well-regulated. And while, yes, we're having a tough time, yes, 140 banks have failed, yes, 500 banks are on the problem loan list. You know, the lion's share of community banks are still very healthy, very strong, and they are lending today. It's just that we have a huge concentration of assets in a few extremely large mega banks, and that's where the core of the banking problem exists.
Well, you mentioned regulation, Mike Menzies, from Easton Bank and Trust in Maryland, and I want to ask you about that because, as you know, I'm positive Congress and the White House are working on overarching banking regulation. Most of it targeted to the big financial institutions. Is the threat of more regulation holding your bank back?
Holding us back? No. A concern? Absolutely. You know, we are examined by five or six different entities on an ongoing basis. You can't imagine how much energy community banks put into compliance and examination. So hopefully the legislation that comes out of the Senate won't punish the community banks, and it'll be focused on the unregulated part of the banking industry and on those who caused the train wreck.
David Gillen at the New York Times, are the small banks cowering in expectation of regulation from Washington at this point?
I think that Mike made a terrific point there about the concentration of power. Really what you have here is those too big to fail banks that really did cause a lot of the problems. I think institutions like Mike's are, you know, they're hoping that they're not too small to succeed. And I don't think the threat of regulation will hold them back from lending. That is their business.
Well, there's your takeaway. Too big to fail versus too small to succeed. Just like us, community and small banks may be as much a victim of the financial crisis. Mike Menzies, president and CEO of Easton Bank and Trust in Easton, Maryland, joined us, and David Gillen, finance editor for the New York Times. Thank you both for joining us. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, here's a look at the headlines.
In the last hour, a test vote on the health care reform bill succeeded in the Senate. Here's Senate Majority Whip Dick Durbin.
On this vote, the ayes are 60, the nays are 39. 3/5 of the senators duly chosen and sworn, having voted in the affirmative, the motion is agreed to.
A final vote on the Senate health care bill is expected on Christmas Eve. U.S. officials are concerned about three American hikers who are being held in Iran. They're worried they may be used as a bargaining chip. A prosecutor in Tehran claims 11 Iranians are being held in the U.S. Iranian officials could ask for a prisoner exchange. And new rules to help air travelers. They say if passengers are stuck on the tarmac for more than 3 hours, the airline will be fined nearly $30,000 per passenger. Consumer advocate Kate Haney says that passengers themselves should get some of the money.
We would like to see that the DOT gives some of the portion of those fines to the passengers.
The rules go into effect in 3 months.
This one's great, Celeste. It's mega lottery time in Spain. This is called the El Gordo Lottery.
And big one.
El Gordo, yeah. It was held today. It better be big. The prize money, over $3 billion. It doesn't all go to one person, though. Nearly 2,000 people take a share in the winnings. And that's a look at some of the top stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, we all think we have airline horror stories, but what if you were stuck on a plane on a tarmac overnight? That has happened, but now the government is taking action. More details on that in just a few minutes.
And you know, we're remixing the holidays all this week. We're talking about new looks at old holiday songs, maybe, and we're asking you, what's your favorite holiday song?
This is Kelly Birchfield from Memphis, Tennessee, and my favorite Christmas song is Something's Up in the Chimney, and I don't know what it is, but it's been there since last Christmas.
8778 My Take or My Take at thetakeaway.org. That's kind of a black holiday song. Let us know what your guilty pleasure carol is at the 8778 My Take.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts on stories we're following this week. And we're joined first by Louise Story, our reporter from the New York Times. And Louise, you know, we're hearing about these arguments between China and the U.S. over climate change. But another one that's been going on for much, much longer is about trade. And it looks like the WTO has come down on the side of the United States, at least in one particular battle. What happened yesterday?
So this trade war is being fought in Geneva, where the World Trade Organization has their appellate board. And they ruled yesterday in favor of the United States. As our trade representative, Ron Kirk, said, today, America got a big win. So they take this very seriously because it's hugely important to the international economy. And what this is about is the hundreds of billions of dollars of money going back and forth. The one yesterday was over books, music, movies that the U.S. companies want to import into China. And I don't know if you know this, but in China, they've got these two state-run media companies that if you are a foreigner and you want to import anything, it's got to go through those companies. And what China says is they're trying to control their culture. They want to look at the content. For instance, they only allow 20 foreign films a year. But what the WTO said in agreement with the United States was you cannot operate a monopoly on these media products. So this is worth billions and billions of dollars for the United States. If China does not follow this, the U.S. can levy trade sanctions on China, which could be worth billions of dollars. It's a big deal.
Well, because everybody knows about being able to buy a brand new movie from China for $1.50, and that's really what's at stake.
Right. It's very at stake, and there's a lot of other issues on the table. So then also yesterday, China started complaining about the U.S. policies on importing Chinese tires.
Right.
Meanwhile, yesterday, the U.S. filed another complaint about China's policy on minerals and what they will export. And so this is a back and forth. There's a lot of these outlying. The U.S. has 8 complaints about China. The China has only 6 complaints about any other country.
Oh, they got to catch up.
Five of them are on the U.S.
Oh,
yeah.
So this is going to be something to watch.
Louise Story, New York Times finance reporter. We will watch it.
Thank you.
All right, let's get a takeout now on travel. There was another big win yesterday for anyone who's ever been trapped on the tarmac while waiting for a flight to take off. That's most of us, unfortunately. This summer in Rochester, Minnesota, an entire plane of people was kept waiting overnight with no food, no option to leave the plane. Here's a sound of a pilot of the flight. He's heard speaking to the hub coordinator on the tarmac.
There's no food, and it's just getting really unhappy. And the problem, too, is that the terminal's closed here.
Yeah.
So we can't even get to the terminal. If they could get off into the terminal and just mill around, but they can't.
All right. That uncomfortable and dehydrating scenario for passengers has been repeated all over the country. It's prompted the federal government to crack down. Matthew Wald covers the airline industry for our partner, the New York Times. Matt, Secretary Ray LaHood, Transportation, spoke about this issue yesterday. What's the decision?
Yeah, well, Todd, you hope it's a victory for passengers. What he said was you can get fined $27,500 per passenger if you leave the passenger on the plane for more than 2 hours without food, water, and access to toilets, and the same amount if you leave the passenger on the plane more than 3 hours without offering the passenger a way to get off. But actually, this is going to divide passengers. You and I might be sitting next to each other. You might be wanting to go to a meeting, a business meeting, and the meeting is going to end before you get there because the plane is so late. I might be trying to catch a flight to Miami to get on a cruise that's leaving tomorrow morning, and I want to sit on that plane for as long as possible, hoping we're going to go. And under this new rule, we're going to, after 3 hours, taxi back to the gate to let you off because you've got that right, and my flight will be even later. So it changes the rules. It may make it more humane. In certain instances, some passengers will be more happy, some passengers will be less happy.
I know that the airline industry loves things like the so-called Passengers Bill of Rights, and they love regulations. So what are they saying about this one?
They're saying it'll raise their costs. It'll be difficult to work out. They're also saying that if the plane has to return to the gate, the chances are better that the plane won't make the flight at all. all, because by the time you get all that done, get you off, get your luggage off, the crew may have reached the point where they're not legal to work any more hours. So the balance between cancellations and delays will change in favor of cancellations.
In favor of cancellations.
Just will be canceled.
All right, Matthew Wald, who covers the airline industry for the New York Times, the balance between regulation and cancellations in the airline industry. Thanks, Matt.
For our last take, we turn it over to listeners like Nick.
This is a terrible, terrible bill that satisfies nobody.
We talked yesterday about the health care deal that was struck over the weekend.
And it creates this culture of Medicaid. It creates a third tier of health care. It's a terrible, terrible bill.
Nick, not happy, but James in New York disagrees. He emails us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. This bill represents a significant change in social insurance policy in America. It will almost inevitably provide a net benefit to the citizens of this country.
Speaking of health care, we talked about a new program from United Health Group where for $45 you can get a doctor's house call. Louise talked about that yesterday. Well, sort of. You get a doctor's visit via the internet. Patricia in Seattle emails us to say, I work in the healthcare industry, but I don't think that, quote, seeing a doctor by computer, especially for an initial visit, is very wise. Doctors need to put their hands on the patients and get to know them. That's harder these days, even in an office visit where doctors might see hundreds of patients a week. Besides, access to computers is still beyond the reach of many, especially those who already don't have access to healthcare.
You can reach us on about anything, really, about 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're always happy to hear from you. And today we want to hear about what your favorite holiday song is.
This is Joseph Lee from Detroit. I got an all-time favorite. It's by Willie Pickens, and it's God Rest You Merry Gentlemen. I had it on my iPod player and played it at the Walmart at full blast, and everyone was pretty much jamming to it. Even the salesman, I thought he was going to yell at me to turn it down. He's like, wow, where'd you get that? That's great.
What's your favorite holiday song? Do you have a carol that's a guilty pleasure for you? Bonus points for singing it. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the president is going to declassify millions of pages of documents. What's in them? We'll tell you in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the president is getting ready to actually declassify millions of documents, many of them, most of them, from the Cold War era. What's in them? We're going to talk about that in a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A little over an hour ago, the health care bill cleared its second 60-vote test in the Senate. Democrats needed all 60 votes again to move the bill forward toward final vote on Christmas Eve. U.S. economic growth in the third quarter was weaker than the previously estimated accounts, according to government numbers released last hour. They showed the economy grew 2.2% in the third quarter, less than what many economists expected. Later this morning, the Labor Department will release home sales numbers. And to help jumpstart the economic recovery, President Obama will gather the CEOs of some community banks at the White House, where he's expected to ask them to lend more, particularly to small businesses. That comes as the recession's jobless toll is draining unemployment comparison funds so fast that, according to federal projections, 40 states will go broke. State programs will go broke within 2 years.
In the last 50 years, every economic downturn has come with an increase in crime, but not this recession. It's different. Preliminary FBI figures show crime falling nationwide during the first 6 months of this year. Criminal justice professor James Allen Fox from Northeastern University says he's not surprised by the figures.
The conventional wisdom might be that a downturn economy would create an increase in crime, but that just is not true. If someone loses their job, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily going to commit crimes to make ends meet.
Turning to the markets, the Dow's up about 18, the NASDAQ is up about 4, and the S&P's up about 1.8. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Since the day he stepped into office, President Obama has promised the American people that his administration would be as clear as glass.
Let me say it as simply as I can. Transparency and the rule of law will be the touchstones of this presidency.
President Obama is expected to sign an executive order by the end of the year to create a national declassification center. It would make thousands of documents available to the American public, both past and present. Most of them are actually from the Cold War. Brian Bender joins us. He's a national security reporter with the Boston Globe. And we also have Jim Harper, director of information policy studies at the Cato Institute. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Brian, the president has not signed this executive order yet, so we don't have a huge number of details. But what do we know about this National Declassification Center?
Well, the idea is that this center, which would be housed at the National Archives in College Park, Maryland, would serve as a clearinghouse, if you will, for a huge backlog of government documents that have not yet been released. And the idea is it would speed up the process of reviewing and declassifying this information from what the process is now, which is oftentimes many agencies have to review a single document before it gets released, and that oftentimes takes years and years and years till everybody gets a look at it and everybody signs off on it. This center would, like I said, serve as a clearinghouse where you'd have all the right people in the same place who could look at this information more quickly and decide whether or not it should be released.
And people have said that a lot of the part of the problem in terms of declassification is exactly what you're talking about, the bureaucracy that slows things down, even when the document itself is pretty innocuous and there's no national security security concerns involved.
Well, exactly. A lot of these documents that we're talking about, millions of them, will oftentimes have information contained in them that was generated by different agencies. For example, a State Department document could make reference to information generated by the CIA. In such a case, the CIA gets a crack at it, the State Department gets a crack at it, and not only does that slow down the process, but oftentimes these agencies are just simply reluctant to release things if they are not forced to. So oftentimes there can be innocuous-type information that gets withheld.
Jim Harper of the Cato Institute, is this, as it seems, a big step forward in terms of making the government more transparent?
Well, it's hard to know whether it's a big step forward and half a step back or half a step forward and a big step back, because these documents have been waiting nearly a decade to be declassified. I think that the establishment of the National Declassification Center is intended to be a step forward. If it works, it definitely will be a step forward, because there's far too much classification of material in the federal government today. But the question is whether it will work, and will the bureaucracies that today cause too much material to be classified and kept classified for too long, will that bureaucracy take over the National Declassification Center and cause the same problems to be replicated in a centralized way rather than a dispersed way?
Brian, Jim, let me ask you both the same question. Brian, with you first. Brian Bender with the Boston Globe. What is the biggest story you think is out there that has not been declassified yet that you're waiting to get more documentation about?
Well, I mean, it's almost impossible to know. I mean, clearly there are lots and lots of documents, as you mentioned earlier, from the Cold War period, relations between the United States and the Soviet Union, operations, for example, along with our allies in NATO. You know, the list goes on. These documents cover all levels of foreign policy, military affairs, and many of them are considered or labeled as part of the permanent record of the United States. In other words, they're classified in a category that requires the government to keep them basically forever, till the end of the republic. So clearly they're of historically significant value.
And Jim, what about you? What are you waiting to get more information about?
Well, likewise, I don't know exactly what's in the documents, but I'm very interested in finding out what they contain, because secrecy is as often a protection for national security as it is a protection against revelation of government malfeasance. The state secrets doctrine, which is a really unfortunate legal doctrine, I think, originated in a case that actually covered up negligent behavior on the part of government officials that caused the death of a person. And so, along with important historical information, we'll probably learn where some bodies are buried that we haven't learned before. Of course, because it is classified, we don't have that information now, but it's very important to get it out, and we shouldn't have to wait many, many decades to get it out. The government should be transparent. The Obama administration's instincts are in the right place. Whether they follow through is an open question.
Well, let me have you listen to something that President Obama said on the 21st of January this year.
For a long time now, there's been too much secrecy in this city. The old rules said that if there was a defensible argument for not disclosing something to the American people, then it should not be disclosed. That era is now over.
So the last question for both of you, what do you think? A backseat quarterback for them? More transparency from the Obama? Is he going to make good on that promise?
Yeah, well, I mean, as Jim pointed out, I think certainly the administration is trying. I think we've seen some evidence that they are meeting resistance from some of the entrenched bureaucracies, particularly the intelligence community. So only time will tell. But I think there certainly is an understanding that transparency is important, not just simply for transparency's sake. It's interesting to know this stuff, but it also can be a check on government behavior. A lot of things that were released in the past led to reforms because, as Jim pointed out earlier, they demonstrated that the government wasn't doing things the way we'd want them to.
Okay, and Jim?
Well, I think early statements in the administration were easy to make, but we have a large government with large bureaucracies, and the national security bureaucracy in particular takes advantage of our security fears to some extent and the fact that there is so much secrecy to build more secrecy in.
Well, we'll see if he makes it. Jim Harper is the Director of Information Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, and Brian Bender joined us. He's the National Security Reporter for the Boston Globe. Thank you both so much for joining us. We are having a fun morning, and it's because of you, our listeners. We're asking you about your guilty pleasure holiday songs, and we've been having lots of people call in, great singers, at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Tell us, what is your favorite holiday song? Bonus points if you sing it for us. We will play it on the air.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick here with Celeste Headley. Mexico City lawmakers voted yesterday to legalize same-sex marriage in the capital city. They became the first city in Latin America to do so. The news raised eyebrows because Mexico is, of course, a conservative, overwhelmingly Catholic nation. Johan Grillo is a Mexico correspondent for Time magazine. He joins us now from Mexico City. Johan, legalization of gay marriage in Mexico City, is it as surprising in Mexico as it is in the United States?
It's not that big a surprise right now because the movement towards these kind of reforms has been really gaining ground the last 3 or 4 years in Mexico. There's already been a law changed in the capital that had allowed same-sex civil unions back in 2006. Not quite gay marriage, but it, you know, did allow certain rights. The new law, you know, now allows all rights to same-sex marriages, including the adoption of children. So this momentum has been building up for several years. So, you know, here we've already been, you know, seeing it happen and not so surprised as a lot of the world is by this new reform.
And what has the church had to say about this?
The church, you know, is very much against it. The Archbishop of Mexico City, Cardinal Norberto Rivera, made a declaration yesterday, quite a strong declaration, saying, you know, this is something we should condemn. They've always been, it's quite a conservative Catholic church in this country that has been very much against the reforms we've seen in Mexico City by a left-wing government.
So in San Francisco and in Vermont and places in the United States where temporarily gay marriage has been legalized or same-sex unions, you do see a lot of gay couples lining up at the gates of the courthouse or the church, as the case may be, to go and get married. Is that happening today in Mexico City?
Well, you know, the law's been passed. It will take some time to actually get through the to actually take effect.
Oh, okay.
They passed the legislation. The mayor has to sign it and so forth. But there were certainly some couples outside the assembly in Mexico City having some celebratory kisses and some celebratory hugs over the new law. So, you know, we should soon see in the coming months, once it does come into full effect, people lining up and we've seen a lot of same-sex civil unions already in the last 3 years, some quite high-profile events following that change in 2006.
So as is so often the case, though, I imagine the big city, Mexico City, is probably a little more liberal than the countryside. What's to stop the Mexican Congress from banning same-sex marriage and, in effect, overturning this move in the city?
Well, it's a very good point, like you said. Mexico City itself has become a very liberal, socially liberal environment, whereas the rest of the country is conservative. But the Congress itself does not have the power to overturn this law. There's likely to be attempts to try and say it's inconstitutional or some way, but it seems very likely this law will stand.
All right, same-sex marriage now legal or soon to be signed into law in Mexico City. Johan Grillo, Mexico correspondent for Time Magazine, thanks for joining us. Coming up, our Remixing the Holiday series continues with Broadway star Brian Stokes Mitchell and members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir talking about their favorite Christmas music. That's later this hour.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley here with Todd Zwillick. Coming up, we are remixing all of your holiday music, and today we're going to have a special guest with Broadway star Brian Stokes Mitchell. He's joined by members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir talking about their favorite Christmas music. Right now, let's check leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. The Senate is off to an early start this morning, and the health care bill has cleared another test vote. Democrats again mustered the 60 votes needed to avoid a Republican filibuster as they push to pass President Obama's plan by Christmas. Meanwhile, Republicans say they're not letting up in their criticism of the Democrats' bill. A Commerce Department report suggests the economic recovery has gotten off to a weaker start than previously believed. The GDP grew at a 2.2% rate in the third quarter.
President Obama is meeting with bankers from a dozen small and community institutions this morning. He's expected to encourage them to lend to small businesses in order to support the economic recovery. New rules say airlines that keep passengers stuck inside on grounded planes for more than 3 hours will face large fines. The airline industry predicted the result will be more canceled flights and inconvenience for passengers. The regulations go into effect in 3 months. And finally, looking ahead, the National Association of Realtors comes out with home sales for November. Later on this morning, those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Just hear those sleigh bells jingling, ring, ting, tingling too. Come on, it's lovely weather for a sleigh ride together with you.
That is Brian Stokes Mitchell, Tony Award-winning Broadway star, channeling some Nat King Cole there. He's singing with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Brian is the featured performer in this year's Mormon Tabernacle Choir Christmas special and on their album, Ring Christmas Bells. The special airs on PBS Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. John Hockenberry and I sat down last week with Brian Stokes Mitchell, a Stokes as he insists that he be called. Welcome.
Thanks, Celeste and John. Great to be here.
And we are joined by two other special guests joining us from Utah, Gene Hill and Elliot Clark, both longtime members of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Gene Hill, you are a soprano.
Yes, I am.
And you have been in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir for how long?
7 years.
And Elliot Clark, you have been in the choir for 18 years.
That long, yes.
Oh, man. Congratulations,
and
guys.
What part do you sing, Elliot?
I'm a second base.
You're a second base. Okay. So, Stokes, many people know you, of course, for your work on Broadway. And, you know, when you go to music school, when you're growing up in singing music, you often have people who end up branching out in two different ways. There's those who go the solo route, and there's those who go the choral route. And you ended up with solo.
Well, yeah, I'm a great believer that it's a good idea to rewrite yourself in, no matter what you're doing. I actually started out in the theater, in musical theater, then went into television, and then went...
No future in television.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. Or radio, too, I hear. Is that true?
Radio, it's hot.
I can tell by you two here, it's hot. You know, I've done a whole lot of different things. I've been now an author of a book. It's called Lights on Broadway. Why not do a great concert with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir? It was a natural progression of, you know, all the things that I like to do, and they're such an incredible choir.
Well, we are here to ask you about what is your favorite Christmas music, but we have Gene Hill and Elliot Clark here, and they brought their favorite Christmas music. The first comes, it's a selection of Gene Hill's. It's called Come Thou Font of Every Blessing. Gene, this is a beautiful Christmas carol, and it's a non-traditional
Nice.
Christmas carol. Can you tell us about this piece and why you like it?
I love this piece because it speaks to everyone. People who are have maybe gone astray, and it talks about how the Savior reaches down and lifts us up and brings us back.
Now let's hear the favorite piece that Elliot Clark brought with us, and this is a gorgeous, gorgeous piece. This is In the Bleak of Winter.
In the bleak midwinter, frosty wind may moan.
That's a Norwegian soloist, Sissel, singing with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Elliot, you, as you've said, have been in the choir for 18 years. You have sung a lot of Christmas music. Why does In the Bleak Midwinter speak to you?
Well, In the Bleak Midwinter speaks to my heart, especially the last verse. If I were a shepherd, poor as I am, what could I give? And ultimately, the last line says, so I give him what I can, which is my heart. And so at the Christmas season, the time of giving and gifts, the importance is, what is it can we give? And so one of the reasons I've stayed in the choir those many years is because that's what I can do. I can give my voice. I can give my heart. That's what it's all about.
And this is a great moment to point out that the Mormon Tabernacle Choir are volunteers. They give their time and their voices for no monetary recompense. What they get is the joy of singing with each other. And Brian Stokes Mitchell, you were able to stand in front of this choir and sing with them. We're hearing right now Angels from the Realm of Glory, a very well-known Christmas music. And can you explain to me what the you stand in front of this huge, I mean, number one, that this choir is massive. That's
yes.
a huge wall of sound coming behind you. What was it like to stand up there and sing in front of this group?
It's pretty special, actually. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir Christmas album from the 1950s was one of our favorite albums in our house, actually.
Yeah.
And to be able to stand, we're dating ourselves, no. And to be able to stand.
I had it on reel-to-reel tape, pal.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hate to say me too, but I did. we had 78, so we cranked our record player. But to stand in front of choir of artists like that, 350 voices, I say all you have to do is ride the wave, really.
Let me get an answer from all three of you on my next question, which is why do we love Christmas music? Why do people who even would never, ever sing publicly sing Christmas carols so much?
Well, I think it's about reconnecting to joy, reconnecting to celebration, reconnecting to family, reconnecting to those things, our childhoods, that have made us feel good in our life. And music, I think, is one of those rare things that connect us, like the sense of smell, in this very primal, quick way to an emotion, to a sense, to a feeling. What about you, Gene and Elliot? What would you think?
I think that's great. Yes, joy is one of the emotions that it evokes, but also hope for the future, hope that's brought through the Savior.
And Elliot?
I absolutely agree. Music, music becomes part of your life memory. And so with all of our lives, the whole span of our life, we'll have music that we recall when we went to that first big date or, you know, when so-and-so proposed, you know. I mean, there are lots of things that music evokes in our lives, and especially at Christmas time, because we have memories, musical memories, that are just delightful to us. And we have some that are can be very poignantly sad and sweetly sad at times as well. But the music of Christmas seems to speak to the heart. And a carol is essentially a dance, and so your heart, your mind, your spirit get to dance at Christmas time. People enjoy that.
Well, this what we're hearing right now is Brian Stokes Mitchell, Gene Hill, and Elliot Clark dancing together. That is Jesu, Joy of Man's Desiring. I'm sure many people recognize that. Brian Stokes Mitchell, Tony Award-winning Broadway star. He can be seen performing in this year's Mormon Tabernacle Choir Christmas Special. It airs on PBS channels on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. The CD is in stores now. Thank you so much, Stokes.
It's my pleasure.
And Gene Hill, soprano with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Elliot Clark, fourth generation choir member. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays, one and all.
John and I talked to all of them last week. Tune in tomorrow for our Remixing the Holidays series. We're going to continue with a Muzak audio architect explaining why different stores play the music that they do. And all this week, we're asking you, what is your guilty pleasure holiday song?
Hello, my name is Eric Cornell from Waterford, Michigan. My favorite Christmas song is, well, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. There's simply no place to go. So let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Here's another one.
Martine from Brooklyn. There's no discussion about holiday songs complete without mentioning Dominic the Donkey.
La la la, it's Dominic the Donkey.
Hey, jingity jing. It's Dominic the Donkey.
Santa's Italian Christmas Donkey, of course.
The Italian Christmas Donkey. La,
la, and because you are good this year, one more for you.
Hi, it's Frank from Westchester County, New York. I don't know why, this is my favorite Christmas song. I don't know if it's by Perry Como, Frank Sinatra, or Tony Bennett. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight.
You can sing all of them. They each did their own versions. Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm Todd Zwillick. It's The Takeaway.
Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.